I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All things political coming up this hour, as it always does, Mondays at 1 o'clock. Our guest this hour is Terrence Samuel. He is Washington politics editor at the Washington Post, a veteran political journalist who is managing editor of congressional coverage at National Journal. He is author of The Upper House, A Journey Behind the Closed Doors of the U.S. Senate, a former national correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he spent 5 years as chief congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and in 2007 helped launch The Root. We have .com, that is. We have a lot to talk about this hour. We will start with, well, some of the news from today. Ben Carson is going to be the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Donald Trump called him a distinguished national leader with a brilliant mind. The recount, presidential recount underway, of course, in Wisconsin. U.S. District Judge ruled earlier today that the Michigan election officials should begin counting today at noon for the recount in Michigan, and the one in Pennsylvania we'll talk about some. We'll probably start with the story of the Dakota Pipeline. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe had a major victory yesterday. The Department of the Army announced that it would not allow the pipeline to be drilled under a dam section of the Missouri River. The Army said it would look for alternate routes for the $3.7 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. But there is some question about how durable this decision would be, because Donald Trump has a different view of the project. Last week said he supported finishing the pipeline. We will talk about that. We'll talk about all this going on Twitter. Yesterday, Donald Trump complaining about the Chinese economy and military policy. This after his unusual call with the president of Taiwan, which prompted a diplomatic protest by the Chinese to the United States. We will look at that. Oh, we have so many other issues. So take us where you want. And here's how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And Terrence, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. Nice to have you with us again. We have so much to talk about. Well, let's start with what happened with, because it all of a sudden started making more and more news, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe getting a major victory yesterday, Department of the Army not allowing the pipeline to be drilled where they were protesting it should not be drilled. But is this something that will change, do you think, with the Donald Trump administration or not?
Well, here we are into the final days of the Obama administration, and we get this kind of glaring illustration of what it means to either win or lose an election.
Mm-hmm.
The authority to do this is entirely in the hands of the executive, the Army Corps of Engineers, not the State Department, like the Trans-Canada XL pipeline, and that the administration decided that they were going to put an end to this section of the pipeline. However, as you suggest, this could easily go the other way sometime post January 20th when President-elect Trump takes over, because he has said very clearly that he is in favor of finishing the pipeline. And then we get into the many, many strange and unpredictable situations that a Trump presidency has spawned, in that he is invested in the company that is building this pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So how this plays out and how these things impact each other, we get to see. But clearly, this is a victory that comes for the tribe, with a lot of concern about how long it'll last.
It would seem to me, and tell me what action might be taken in this regard, but he's going to run into trouble with the investments that he has all over the world. There have been questions about the phone call he took from Taiwan, if indeed they're looking at hotels in Taiwan, his daughter meeting in on the meeting with the Japanese prime minister, and she has dealings with her clothing company going on in Japan. And as you said, he's got a financial interest owning stock in the company that is building the pipeline. You really can't be saying all the time, wait a second, he has a financial interest. Oh, wait a second, he has a financial interest. Don't you think something will be done and has to be done in that regard?
Well, what he has said is that he will divest himself from managing the businesses, and so which is different from divesting in the businesses themselves, that he will turn this over to his children, and the conflict of interest will therefore not apply. However, as we see, none of this seems to trickle down to the actual reality of somebody with Trump's global business interest running the country. There just seems to be no place where this does not apply. And, you know, even the meeting with the Japanese prime minister, his daughter is sitting in, and she is supposedly part of the buffer that will keep the president-elect from this conflict of interest. She's in the meeting, and she is apparently part of a deal taking place in Japan as that meeting is taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for those of us who've been watching this, there's a sense that no, we won't be able to say time and time again that he's got an interest, but it doesn't seem that it's going to go away, and so we will have to figure out a different way to talk about it, examine it, keep it clear and transparent as best we can.
You'll have a lot of reporting on this.
There's
going to be a lot to report.
There is an enormous amount of reporting to be done. There's never been a presidency like this.
Yeah. Ben Carson is now in the cabinet, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Donald Trump called him a distinguished national leader with a brilliant mind. Others have said, how is he qualified to be Secretary of Housing and Urban Development?
Well, the interesting thing about this is Ben Carson, at the outset of the transition after Donald Trump won the election, said that he was probably not interested in a cabinet job because, to quote him, he would be a fish out of water as a federal bureaucrat. But I think what you see is, and you know, we pointed out in a story this weekend that the cabinet looks completely unlike anything we've seen before, just in terms of kind of the number of millionaires and billionaires. What Donald Trump is doing in assembling his cabinet is surrounding himself not so much with policy expertise or long experience, but people who have been loyal, and you know, that's one strategy. But I don't think anybody is making the case that Ben Carson is preeminently qualified to be Housing and Urban Development Secretary. What he is a loyal Trump supporter, and that accounts for something.
Let's talk about all these tweets that have been going on. He, first of all, takes this call from the president of Taiwan. Then we get this diplomatic protest with the U.S. that was given by the Chinese. Now we have tweets yesterday complaining about Chinese economic and military policy. Is he already embarking on a different kind of China policy?
Clearly. So the Taiwanese phone call at first seemed like kind of a blunder, where he kind of stumbled into something without having the kind of full historical and political context for how this relationship works. We learn later that there are people in his inner circle who have been thinking about this for months because they thought that this was a chance and an opportunity to establish early on that there is going to be a different U.S.-China relationship. That's what the phone call seemed to do. The response to the protests, essentially a series of tweets challenging China to think differently about how they behave, seems to suggest that that's exactly what happened. And yes, that is a completely different approach to the kind of you know, quiet give and take, a relationship that we've described in the Washington Post as frenemies.
Mm-hmm.
Trump apparently has decided that he is going to be a little more confrontational,
mm-hmm.
based on these on the little tweet storm.
You've covered Washington for a long time. Is it unusual to not talk to the State Department if you're an incoming president, to talk with people who have established relationships with countries all over the world before you take phone calls?
It's unusual, but we elected an unusual and, non-traditional. I mean, he did not come to this job the way many people came to this job. Governors, senators, people who've been in Washington kind of know how the protocol works and are willing to abide by them. They, you know, there are a bunch of, you know, President Obama recently has been lamenting that there are norms and customs that ought to be followed, and he's not doing that. And in part, you know, his strategy all along has been, I ignored the advice and counsel of all the experts
right. Who
did not think I could win, and now I am the president-elect, and he is affirmed in his approach. And yes, it's unusual not to be briefed on, you know, crucial relationships that that have long histories and delicate terrain to be covered.
Mm-hmm. There is something strange about using Twitter all the time, and also the president-elect to be making fun of, well, Saturday Night Live, which I did watch on Saturday, making fun of his tweets all the time. And then he tweets back that he disapproves of that. Just tried watching SNL. Unwatchable, he says. And then he says how sad it is. But this television show is going to be really on him for a long time on a lot of policies. He's going to have to get used to at least 4 years of SNL. And Baldwin really making fun of him in some cases, or really skewering him in others, but it's a satirical show, right?
Right. So I think a couple of things. One, he comes to this with an unprecedented level of concern for that kind of activity. He comes from television.
Right.
He comes from New York. He has spent much of his time being a figure in public. He is now maybe the most public person in the world, and I'm not sure that he understands, quite frankly, the marginal difference between Donald Trump, the celebrity, to the president of the United States, which is, he is going to get so much attention. Quite frankly, that I don't think he's going to know what to do with it. Tweeting back to every incident you find a little offensive is, I think he's going to have to grow out of that, quite frankly.
I think he'll probably have a few other things to do, won't he?
Yes.
Yeah, I would think so, Terrence. Recount. U.S. District Judge early today issued an order for the Michigan election officials to begin counting. So they're counting now at noon today in the state of Michigan. The recount is underway in the state of Wisconsin. What are your overall thoughts about this recount from Jill Stein? Is it a worthwhile activity, do you think? Is it important?
So I guess we have to think about motives here. Jill, the Stein effort seems mostly an effort to, I think, poke and prod the Trump campaign, which has showed itself to be susceptible to that kind of poking and prodding and responding poorly to challenges like that. But there, on a different level, I think, given how much we talked about elections being rigged and illegal votes taking place in a number of states, nobody thinks that this is going to change the election. But I think it's an interesting and probably worthwhile civic exercise for people to see how this works. And in the end, particularly if what we find out is that, you know, the system worked as it should.
Mm-hmm. And what about the other voting issue here that he has said that millions of people voted illegally yesterday? Reince Priebus said, look, I don't know that that's a false statement. And now people are saying you'll have to prove that people didn't vote illegally. Wouldn't you be able to get some indication if that was a problem with the recounts underway now in Michigan and Wisconsin?
He has been and his supporters have been against these recounts. However, making the claims that he's made has been basically the best argument for the recounts that we've heard. If he thinks that these things actually happened, that there was all this illegal voting and voter fraud and people who should not have voted having had a chance to vote, mm-hmm. A recount is probably the best way to answer that question. And so, I think, you know, what we have is kind of a little bit of a theatrical event taking place here where people on the Hillary Clinton anti-Donald Trump side are really, I think, upset by the fact that she won the popular vote and somewhere deep inside feel that somehow this election was illegitimate for that reason. That is not the case. On his side, I think he is a little bit sensitive about having lost the popular vote and is a little concerned about how close the vote is in those states. Nothing changes, I think, the eventual outcome, but these recounts, I think, continue the argument that basically started between these two sides mm-hmm. before and during the voting.
And before we go to phone calls, we have a lot of other issues, but let's talk about the appearance at Carrier's Indianapolis factory announcing a deal, Donald Trump and Mike Pence, with the company to keep about 1,000 jobs in the state. And then he went beyond that and talked about how tough he's going to be on businesses that move outside the United States. He wants to lower taxes and slash regulations for companies here, and also this 35% tariff on companies moving jobs overseas. Was the Carrier deal an indication of how he'll deal with other companies? Does a president have the time to call every company in the country that's thinking of moving overseas and having a conversation with them and trying to get them to stay here?
I think it's an indication of the kind of thing he's most comfortable with. He is a guy who is willing to get on the phone and make a phone call and cut a deal.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed available here. You know, the actual consequences of how many jobs were saved and how many jobs actually left, still very much kind of an open question of how much of a win that was. I think he disturbed a lot of his supporters by the approach that he announced that he would take against companies who were essentially, in their minds, trying to be profitable and stay profitable and serve shareholder value and bill value. And if having to leave is one of their options, I don't think they want that off the table, which has been kind of the question that American manufacturing has been dealing with for much of the last 20 to 30 years. It became a big boon for him in this election, and I think he feels the need to continue to voice that, but it's going to be a hard, hard thing for him to pull off going forward.
And we're going to welcome phone calls. Terrence Samuel is Washington politics editor at the Washington Post. We're doing all things political, and we have a number of other issues to delve into during the course of the hour. We'll look at some of the important elections. The Italian prime minister is going to resign, which deals a blow to the European Union. Austria, the far-right candidate lost in Austria. We'll look at that and the future of elections in Europe, which are important. Are we seeing a real wave of populist candidates winning, and what does that mean really for the world? We're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. What do you think of Donald Trump's thank you tour? What do you think about what he said in Ohio? Is he bringing the country together, which he says he wants to do, or doing the opposite? There are now we don't know who it's going to be, but evidently we have gone beyond four people being considered for Secretary of State: Mitt Romney, Rudy Giuliani, Senator Bob Corker, and former CIA Director David Petraeus. And evidently other people are being considered, although I don't know who they are at this point. So join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to your phone calls. And we start with John in Appleton. Hey, John.
Hey, Kathleen and guests. Thanks very much for all you do. I have a question, and admittedly, I'm I was a Bernie voter in the primary, and then I switched and supported Hillary in the general. You know, Donald Trump talks about bringing back wages and bringing back, or hiking wages and bringing back jobs. But I have a kind of a crazy fear. Not, and I've never shopped at the store, but apparently Walmart sells a lot of stuff made in China. So if Trump, President Trump, gets aggressive with China, won't it end up biting him in the butt because the prices at Walmart and other places like it will go up? Hence, you know, kind of biting people who voted for him, you know, in their pocketbooks. I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, John. Terrence.
So the U.S.-China relationship is tricky for two big reasons. One, they are militarily formidable, and we don't want to get into a big shooting match with China. So you see kind of skirmishes around, you know, the South China Sea and those issues, and we are working really hard to make sure that this thing doesn't go south pretty quickly. The other is this amazingly significant economic relationship, and what the caller describes, Walmart and much of a lot of things sold in the American economy are made in China, but China is also a huge importer of American goods. So a lot of what we make and sell is sold in China. If we get into a trade fight with China, and certainly if we get into a trade fight with China and lose much of the economy in Southeast Asia, which is growing, it could be bad for not just the people who voted for Donald Trump, but the American economy in general.
Thanks very much for the call, John. We go to Kurt next in Waukesha. Hi, Kurt.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering, they never think of, like, if you move a factory out, the infrastructure that supports the factory also supports the area residents, in your incoming electrical power, your water, the roads that are built to actually make a product, load it on a truck, and distribute it from there. So you lose that. How are the residents supposed to pick up that tab?
You just described a lot of what happened to a lot of manufacturing communities across the United States over the last 30 years. So not only did they lose the factory, but you lose the factory, and then you lose the hospital, and then you lose the community college, and then the water system doesn't have enough income so that the rates go up, people leave, and you have, you know, what is described as depressed former manufacturing communities all across the country. And this has been, I think, the conversation taking place in a lot of communities across America, and Donald Trump seemed to one, suggest that he understood the problem, and two, to offer a solution, even if it was not very specific. And I think a lot of people are hoping that he can actually solve this, but a lot of people have tried.
Well, he's going to have to, right? Because people are counting on him to do what he said he was going to do. That's why he is president, right?
He is absolutely obligated to try.
Let's talk about Secretary of State for just a moment before we go back to phone calls. It's my understanding that there are four people who had been seriously considered, but now they're searching beyond that pool of four. Have you heard anything about who they're talking to now?
So the list is expanded to include Rex Tillerson, the former chief executive at Exxon, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and a few others. It's been a remarkable process, to say the least, and interesting in that Secretary of State is usually kind of the tone setting appointment that a new president makes, and this one has been kind of publicly remarkable and a little melodramatic, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. So you don't know what the deal is with Mitt Romney. They don't like him. Some people don't like him on the Trump staff.
So clearly some people don't like him on the Trump staff because he said some pretty horrible things about Donald Trump when he was a candidate. Some people see it as a way to see an appointment of Mitt Romney as a way to heal the party, bring the establishment in a little closer.
Mm-hmm.
There are people in the inner circle who feel that that is absolutely a terrible idea and have made it public that they think it's a bad idea. You know, one of the amazing things is watching this effort is how humiliating it's been for. I mean, Mitt Romney had to do two of those dinners. Petraeus had former CIA director Petraeus had to live through a recounting of all of his past sins, including an affair and his conviction for. And then Rudy Giuliani, who basically said he had the job, now obviously doesn't. And it's hard to see how this how this works as a stabilizing pick when it happens. But that's absolutely what he needs to do. He needs somebody to say that this is a serious administration and there's a serious person in this job. We'll see how that goes. That still seems a few days away, is what our reporting.
It's interesting you use this phrase, bring the establishment in. I'm wondering if indeed there will be a difference between the Republican establishment and Donald Trump, or if the establishment will change and become more like what Donald Trump is, which is quite unorthodox.
Good question, and I certainly don't know the answer to that. I think he is so anomalous to basically everything that happens in Washington that, in fact, you know, it's his selling point, right? He's going to drain the swamp, and that hasn't happened. But, you know, the Republican establishment believes in a few things. I mean, it's an easy question. What does it mean to be a Republican? It's, you know, lower taxes, smaller government, you know, caution the world not to be too adventurous. Donald Trump doesn't feel passionately about any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it is going to be interesting to see who gives up what in terms of ideology and commitment to make the administration work.
Let's go to Jeff in Madison next. Hello, Jeff.
Yes, Tip O'Neill obviously once said all politics is local, and that's true except when it's not. And we've all been just watching this stumbling into international affairs. And a very quick story. I was in Gujarat, India, about a few years ago working with state government officials about the Gujarat earthquake, and they were the most welcoming, friendly, just wonderful, open people one could ever hope for. Well, one night at dinner, I just inadvertently mentioned or brought up something about Kashmir, and it's as though someone had suddenly held a gun at their heads, and they just became almost outraged. And the fact that he's taking calls from Pakistan and saying fantastic this and fantastic that, he hasn't got a clue about the tensions that are out there. That could well be perhaps second flashpoint, nuclear flashpoint in the world after North Korea. And I just don't think he has a clue as to what he's stepping into. And that's it. I just thought.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Terrence?
So, I mean, I think a lot of people heard the Kashmir phone call and were mind. It boggles the mind that conversation could take place. I think a lot of other people heard that phone call and thought, well, this is refreshing. We're not stuck in the old way of thinking. But I think the big worry is that it's not strategic. It's kind of without historical context. And if that is the case, we could, in fact, stumble into something that we don't understand with pretty dire consequences. I mean, that happens, you know, when everybody is kind of up on all the information and working from the same playbook, and still mistakes happen diplomatically. If this is not the case and we're kind of making it up as we go, it could be dangerous.
Thanks, Jeff, very much for your call. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. Terrence Samuel is our guest, Washington politics editor at the Washington Post. Mary in Marshfield. Hi, Mary.
Back to Trump's announcement, you know, about what he's going to do for companies that export their manufacturing. that's all well and good, but you know, if I were leading one of those companies or if I were on their board of directors, I would probably say, you know, we need to get way more into automation here. You know, you don't have to replace them with Mexicans or some other country's workers. Why don't we replace them with robots? I mean, that there's a lot of upsides to robots. But there's one big downside. They're not supporting families. But, you know, doesn't it make sense that they would put their money and anything they do from now forward into that? I would.
Terrence.
Yeah, I mean, a 35% tariff on companies that move jobs is kind of mind-blowing in a lot of ways. But I think what it points up and what the case Mary makes is, you know, none of this is simple. It has not been simple, and I think people were desperate for, like, a simple solution to these questions. Donald Trump seems to have had an answer, and now I think he's trying to deliver on that, and it is going to become increasingly obvious by the day how difficult the task is to deliver on what he promised. That would have been the case for a lot of people, but people have put a lot of faith in him saying that he was going to do a series of things that was going to reverse a trend that they had been seeing over their recent lifetimes, and the solutions are not at all easy, and as Mary points out, there are a lot of ways to make this economy work without dealing with a 35% tariff on your company if that's what happens.
Thank you, Mary, very much for your call. Let's go to Dave in Madison next. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I think Donald Trump created an insurmountable problem for himself during his campaign. He spread poison everywhere he went, and he's poisoned the well. There is no coming back from that. He's an evil man. It's dawning on us now that he's a rather stupid man. And there's just not going to be, you know, we're not going to fix this.
Well, a lot of people voted for him, Dave.
A lot of people made a bad judgment. A lot of people believe in global warming is a myth. How about you?
Terrence.
It's so this is the problem that Donald Trump faces. Tough, hard, difficult elections are nothing new in America. People eventually, when they're on the losing side, most people say, I lost, they won, I disagree with what they believe in, I'm against what they're trying to do, but this is the way democracy works. I think Donald Trump has, in fact, created a level of venom that is going to make it harder than usual for people to get behind him, people who didn't vote for him, to get behind him, to do some of what he hopes to do. And that's a lot of people.
He, Charles Blow had an interesting piece in today's New York Times Sorry, it's the Times, and you're from the Post, but what the heck.
That's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. He was talking about his thank you tour, and he says, and I quote, Donald Trump had a chance to step beyond division and the acrimony of his campaign, but declined. He's choosing to push America further apart rather than bring it closer together. Do you think that's true?
The thank you tour does not feel like it's reaching beyond the people who voted for him. The thank you tour feels like a thank you to the people who voted for him. The campaign was just so nasty that at some point that nastiness needs to be addressed head on. A tour to places where you lost might begin to do that. This doesn't feel like it's happening. It may be too soon. He's got lots of other things to do, but I would have to agree that I don't see the venom and the divisions ending anytime soon.
Thanks, Dave, for your call. Chuck in Sauk County. Hello, Chuck.
Hi, Howard. Thank you. I got two comments. I think, one, Donald Trump wants to drain the swamp, but first he's going to save all the animals. And the next one is, I think what he's doing is picking and choosing these folks that ran against him and talked bad against him and stuff, and he's going to string them along and then destroy their careers by that. So I just take my comments off the air. Thank
people
you.
Like who? Mitt Romney? Is that who you're talking about? Or
yeah, Mitt Romney and a few of these others, you know, that came out and you know, debated against him, and you know, now he's stringing them along and you know, he's going to lower the boom on them here someplace.
Thanks, Chuck, very much for your call. Let's talk about health care for a moment. Repeal and replace Obamacare is something that Donald Trump talked about while campaigning quite a bit. From what I've been reading, it's going to be a lengthy process. You may repeal it right off the bat, but in order to replace it, it's going to take, look how long it took to get the Affordable Care Act. It took forever. It took years to do this. It's unrealistic to think that his administration is going to be able to put something else in place even within a year, don't you think?
It's going to be hard. This is going to be one of the hardest things to do. You know, think back. I mean, one of the things about Washington is it changes, but it changes very, very slowly. The passing of the Affordable Care Act was a long and painful process that happened in part because Democrats had overwhelming majorities in at least the Senate and majorities in the House. And that was hard to do. It happened without a single Republican vote. Now, in terms of replacement, already you see senators and Republicans expressing concern about what happens to people who are already on the Affordable Care Act, who like it, who will need something to replace it. So I think putting together, certainly no Democrats voting for replace and repeal, putting together the votes to actually repeal it and replace it is something that's going to take a really long time in this town because it is at least as it's certainly more divided than it was, six years ago when this happened, and it is going to be a tough slog. And the other thing they need to think about is this something they want to invest their time and political capital in, given the number of people who will be affected negatively.
Let's go next to Dick in Oak Creek. Hi, Dick.
Hi there. I'm curious. I'd like to get your input on this, and I have a follow-up question, too. I really don't believe Trump's going to do what he says he's going to do at all. I don't think jobs are coming back. He knows jobs aren't coming back. And I'm wondering what... where do you think the reaction will be of the Trump supporters who really believe he's going to bring these jobs back?
So there's been a lot of speculation about how much the people who voted for Trump believed that he was being literal when he said he was going to do these things. And I think there is sufficient evidence to suggest that, like your caller, a lot of people who actually voted for Mr. Trump didn't actually believe certainly everything that he said he was going to do. So the question for him becomes, what does success look like in the face of people willing to forgive the bold brag about what was going to happen and having lowered their expectations, what is it that he needs to deliver so that they feel like he affirms that he was actually on their side and did something for them? And I actually don't know what that looks like. It's certainly not a carrier deal in every town across America, and it's certainly not bringing back a lot of those jobs that have disappeared. Some people have made the argument that basically what Trump did was give voice to a certain level of frustration. And if those people don't feel abandoned and they feel like life is getting better, that even if the jobs don't come back, they may feel somewhat vindicated in their choices.
Well, he could do a $1 trillion infrastructure bill, right? He could probably get support from Democrats. He could put people back to work at good-paying jobs, and people would be happy with that, wouldn't they?
People would be happy with that, except that there are a lot of Republicans in Congress in Washington who would be against the idea of a massive infrastructure spending bill that that ramps up the federal deficit, which has been, again, an argument that has been going on in this town for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
How much money do you spend on what, and how much debt are you willing to go into to grow the economy?
More phone calls momentarily. Terrence Samuel is our All Things Political guest today. He's Washington politics editor at the Washington Post. He was managing editor of congressional coverage at National Journal, author of The Upper House, A Journey Behind the Closed Doors of the U.S. Senate, former national correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer and St. Louis Dispatch. He also worked as chief congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have two lines open now if you'd like to grab one of them. talk@wpr.org is our email address. The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook, where you can also leave messages. This is the Ideas Network. Next caller is Tom in Minocqua. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen. I don't know if you saw yesterday on This Week, Mike Pence was on and George Stephanopoulos asked him about the tweet about the 1 million fraudulent votes being cast. And he was pretty dogged in pushing it. Pence's answer was basically, it's refreshing to have someone who speaks his mind. It's refreshing to have somebody who tells it like it is or whatever. And, I mean, George Stephanopoulos went at him again and again. But he's, you know, it's refreshing. The media, I don't know how they deal with this, because here was 4 minutes spent dealing with just something ridiculous. And meanwhile, important issues don't get addressed. And I fear it's going to be like that all the time. We're going to be going after tweets, and major important things aren't going to be addressed. I guess I wonder, how does the media confront this?
Terrence, what are you going to do about it?
So you just described our lives for the last 18 months. There has been this trend, particularly, frankly, with the Trump campaign, of saying things that are kind of a little bit not true or not true. And the defense has been, stop being so politically correct, or people don't actually believe what we say. And it's frustrating for us, quite frankly, because it is difficult to have kind of a serious conversation when everybody's not at least agreed on kind of the same history and the same fact pattern that we're talking about. To say that it's refreshing that somebody said millions of people voted illegally when that just did not happen, it feels like first you have to address that before you could get to the next question. They have been rather successful in in saying things that that defy reality and quite frankly, getting away with it.
Thank you, Tom, for your call. Ruth Eau Claire, hi.
Yeah, I'm just calling about what I'm reading is the intention to, the likely intention to privatize Medicare, VA benefits, Medicaid, things like that. And the, you know, the impact of that nationwide, certainly within our own state, when you have these large insurance corporations who come in and this public, these public dollars get handed over to them, they're obligated to make sure that their shareholders make, you know, money. And the only, number one, they don't, in these insurance companies don't understand long-term care. Secondly, you have the only way to save money is to restrict dollars that go to help the people who rely on the fund.
Do you think there will be a serious attempt to go after Medicare?
Yeah.
You
there's,
do.
I mean, I think there's a, I mean, this is at least, this is recognizable. There is a fundamental difference about how we should handle the safety net between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans have this view that it should be privatized. Democrats think that's irresponsible and would lead to abuses in the private sector that, in fact, can destroy the safety net. That argument has been going on. Clearly, the people in charge of the traditional Republican Party, by which I mean Speaker Ryan, who has been somewhat of a proponent of this, are now in position to make the argument that this is what should happen, that this is what people voted for, and they have the numbers both in the House and the Senate, and maybe somebody in the White House willing to sign it. That, however, I think takes on such unbelievable proportions in terms of the political discourse in this country that I think that's a much bigger fight than anybody is.
Oh, I agree.
Is prepared for.
Right.
There may be not enough Republicans who remember the Social Security privatization of 2005, but I think enough people remember that that they will be a little cautious in how they proceed. This happened after the George W. Bush reelection. People thought they had political capital to spend. They thought they had a mandate to move on this. And by 2006, they had lost both the House and the Senate.
You know, there are things that are almost sacrosanct, at least for the moment, Social Security, and another one is Medicare. You have a huge fight to privatize both of those.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the times in which we live. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate your time and your thoughts about a variety of topics, Terrence.
Thanks for having
it
me.
It ain't dull, is it?
Old Chinese curse, right?
Exactly. You live in interesting times, you are. Terrence Samuel, our guest for All Things Political, Washington politics editor at the Washington Post, and he's worked for a number of places. National Journal, he was the editor of congressional coverage. He's worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, U.S. News and World Report, and in 2007, he helped launch TheRoot.com. For those of you who may not know about All Things Political, we do this show absolutely every Monday from a variety of perspectives. A lot of people are journalists who are covering national politics, and we have professors on and right and left and center and all over the place. So it's Mondays at 1 o'clock. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We are going to spend some time and good time on bringing jobs to the central city of Milwaukee and the efforts underway to do just that, the problems associated with that. That's coming up with the mayor of Milwaukee, the commissioner of the Department of City Development, and someone else will be joining us. So stay tuned.